Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today, we are starting a regular series on worker uprisings across the country. Here is just a sample of actions. Nurses across the country have been protesting over staffing issues and patient care. Workers at Jack in the Box in Sacramento, California, walked off the job yesterday, demanding $184,000 in back pay. Workers say, imagine not getting a break for 9 years. Imagine working 16-hour shifts, but being paid at a regular hourly rate. That was our reality. We demand what we are owed. Last week, McDonald's workers walked off the job in Little Rock, California, demanding better working conditions. They say they want an air conditioner that does not constantly break down. On today's Your Call, we will discuss three worker uprisings. Later in the show, we'll talk about the Frito-Lay strike in Kansas, and we'll talk about the garment workers in Los Angeles who are still fighting for a minimum wage. We begin by discussing the more than 1,000 coal miners in Alabama who've been on strike for the last 5 months, fighting for better pay, working conditions, and benefits. They have been working under the same contract for the past 5 years. Workers say their pay and benefits have decreased, while CEO pay and production in the mines have increased. The miners work at the Warrior Met Coal Plant in Brookwood, Alabama, and are members of the United Mine Workers of America Union. Last week, the strike made its way to New York City in front of the offices of BlackRock, the world's largest hedge fund and Warrior Met's largest shareholder. Several BlackRock executives now work in the Biden administration. BlackRock's Mike Pyle is the chief economic advisor for Vice President Kamala Harris. Yesterday, members of the United Mine Workers of America held a large rally in Brookwood, Alabama, with miners from Illinois, Indiana, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Kentucky, and West Virginia. They came to express support for the local miners. Joining us to give us an update is Kim Kelly, a labor columnist at Teen Vogue, who has been extensively following this uprising. Kim's book, Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor, will be out next April. And Kim joins us from Alabama, where she has been covering yesterday's strike. Hi, Kim. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you so much for covering this story.
Well, it's great to have you, Kim. I just want to start off by acknowledging that AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka just died of a massive heart attack, and you tweeted that yesterday he appeared via video to send solidarity to the striking miners in Alabama.
Yeah, it's very poignant to think about the fact that one of the last actions he may have done as a labor leader, as a former UMWA president, was to have sent that message. And, you know, I don't know if it was pre-recorded or if it was live, but it was up on a big screen. Everybody was watching. And, of course, there were many veterans of the Pittston strike that he helped lead back in the 80s. So it's a very, you know, it's wild, honestly. It's wild. And I think it's kind of beautiful in a way that that was one of his last expressions of solidarity out to his UMWA brothers and sisters in Alabama.
Right, and I was watching video of the strike yesterday, and a lot of miners from all over the country showed up. It was really, really hot, but they wanted to show up to express their solidarity. What really struck you about that action?
It was amazing seeing just how many people still made the trek. And one of the things that kind of stuck with me was the fact that so many folks were actually retirees, or like people who had worked in the mines for decades upon decades. People who, you know, when they were walking up to the rally, you could see the toll that the mines had taken on them and what it had done to their bodies. And some of these folks came from hours and hours away. Like, these are long bus rides, like busloads of folks were brought in. And just the amount of effort and resolve it takes to do that kind of journey when you're older, when you're, you know, your joints are what they are, when you're not feeling your best, just to show support to people who are continuing that fight, I thought that was such a beautiful display. And I think the folks there in Alabama really felt that. They felt that support. They felt that solidarity. Other unions from across the South and the country showed up, a large contingent of dock workers from Mobile and from South Carolina came down to show their support. And they had some really stirring things to say. President of the Flight Attendants Union, Sarah Nelson, came by and she spoke and got everyone all riled up. And It was really nice, honestly. It was just really nice to see so much support for a strike that's been going on for so long and for workers who have been struggling so hard and coming up against this brick wall time and time again.
Kim, can you just give us a sense of what it is like to be a miner today? What are you hearing from workers?
It's, you know, things have changed since the early 1900s, certainly, but some things haven't. You know, you're still, and you know, the workers at Warrior Met, they're underground 12 hours a day in near complete darkness. You know, there's often water on the floor that they have to deal with. They're, you know, they're breathing in coal dust. The mine that they work at, Warrior Met, is actually one of the deepest in North America and has a high incidence of methane gas. You know, there was a massive explosion about 2 decades ago that killed 13 miners. You know, there's a lot of death and a lot of heartbreak in those mines. I met a young man one of my last trips down who was about 22 years old. He and his dad moved down there from Kentucky because they wanted to work in a union mine. Alabama is unique in that regard. It's heavily unionized in the mining sector. And a couple weeks into his job at Warrior Met, he was crushed between two massive pieces of machinery underground. Mm. And now he's not going to be able to walk. And, like, this is the kind of thing that happens to folks. Like, it's still really hard. It's still really dangerous. And then when you have a company like Warrior Met that refuses to pay people properly, to compensate them properly for health care, to rake them over the coals and give them no wiggle room to live a life and to see their families, it's just unconscionable.
Mm. You know, you have reported that prior to April 1st, the miners were trying to get a better contract deal with Warrior Met, but workers were not offered anything decent, and that's why they called the strike?
Yeah, basically, so they had to work under a 5-year agreement. 5 years previously, Warrior Met came into the mines. The company who had owned the mines before that, Walter Resources or Walter Energy, they went bankrupt, so everyone got laid off. And then Warrior Met came in, and they're like, okay, we'll hire you all back, and this is the concessions we're going to need for you to accept in order for us to sign this contract and get things going. There was the implication that, okay, once the company gets on its feet in 5 years, then those benefits will trickle down and they'll get a better deal. But when they came to the table prior to April 1st and were starting to negotiate, it became apparent that the company was not going to share. It was not going to hold up its end of the bargain. And that's essentially why the strike came to be. It's an unfair labor practice strike. The company is not bargaining in good faith. They're not offering any meaningful concessions or anything meaningful at the bargaining table. And they've been in an impasse for months. And that's why they're still out there. You know, they're not going to go back to work until they have a decent deal.
And their pay was slashed by $6 an hour?
Yeah, it's down to about $22 an hour is the average. And that's, you know, the aforementioned 12-hour a day, 6 days a week, dangerous conditions, dangerous health risks for $22 an hour in a coal mine in a company that has you know, Wall Street capital keeping its coffers full. I don't know how you justify that. I don't know how the Warrior Met CEOs and such sleep at night. But, you know, the workers are fighting back.
You report that 80% of the workers are parents, and they're getting about $1,300 a month as long as they're on the picket line. Now, of course, it's impossible to live on $1,300 a month, although we should say that a lot of people are forced to do that, especially those on Social Security. And you report that there has been a food pantry that's been set up. What are you hearing from people about just survival, you know, $1,300 a month and almost 5 months of striking?
It's tough, you know, like it's hard to raise a family on that much money. It's about $1,400, give or take, but, you know, the really robust mutual aid efforts and community care that has sprang up around this strike is really what's keeping it going. Like the women, and, you know, it's women and retirees and spouses, like there's a bunch of people involved in auxiliary, but there's a group of women who have really thrown themselves into organizing the strike pantry, collecting donations, putting together groceries that they hand out to miners' families every week. They cook a big meal for everybody and hand that out at the weekly UMWA rallies at Tannehill State Park. They've been spreading the word on social media and trying to get the story out there because it has been hard to get media to pay attention. And they're kind of the heart and soul of the strike, really, the auxiliary members. And these are folks who are volunteers. They're married to minors. They're the family members of minors. They're retired minors. Some of them have their own jobs they have to attend to. A lot of them have children and family members to care for. It's really kind of an all-hands-on-deck situation because the strikers, they need to be out on that picket line, and everyone else kind of needs to pick up that slack and keep everything going because, you know, after 5 months, it's getting grim. But they're already planning for Christmas, you know. I just spoke to a friend there the other day, yesterday when I was there, about how they're already making plans for, you know, a toy drive and Santa Claus and things like that because they're not backing down, you know, and they're not going anywhere, even if the going keeps getting even tougher.
Tell us more about BlackRock. The strike made its way to New York City in front of BlackRock's offices last week, the world's largest hedge fund and Warrior Met's largest shareholder. You were there, and again, a number of coal miners in the streets of Manhattan. What really stood out for you at that rally?
They've been up there twice by now. A smaller group went a few weeks previous, and then everyone came up last week. There were buses of there was instances of buses of miners, UMWA members coming from multiple other states. I think we had Pennsylvania, Kentucky, West Virginia out there last time. And just seeing the contrast of the sea of camo, because the UMWA shirts are camo, the sea of camo in front of this, you know, harsh, brutalist BlackRock building with all these skyscrapers with the noise and hustle and bustle of New York City unfolding around them. It was kind of surreal, you know. It was definitely different from being at a rally in Brookwood, you know, out in the woods in a more rural area. And I think there's a lot of energy there. I think they really needed that boost, you know, because it's easy to fall into a routine, especially when you're stuck in a long strike like this and to feel bogged down and feel a little discouraged. But coming on a big adventure to New York City, where most folks had never been before and never really thought they'd make it to. You know, I took a few of the folks sightseeing the night before, and we had a great time. They got to see the Statue of Liberty, and one woman told me that had been one of her bucket list items. She's like, I'm 51 years old, and I've never left the South, and I've always wanted to see the Statue of Liberty. And the strike brought her up there for that. And just that human element of feeling, you know, of just seeing people get excited and see their friends be doing some big, cool activity and sticking it to the man. I think they really needed that boost. And, of course, the media attention around that has been helpful, too, because public pressure has been kind of lacking for this strike. And that's what we need to really put Warrior Met's feet to the fire.
We'll talk about the lack of media coverage in a minute, but first let's hear a clip. This is Mike Wright, a striking Alabama coal miner at Warrior Met who traveled to Manhattan to protest in front of BlackRock's offices. And thanks to the Real News Network for this clip.
Sick of it?
Yeah.
Are you sick of CEOs dictating your lives, where you live and where you work? Say yes. Hell yeah!
I put everything, my whole heart, in working for this company, and I want what we deserve. We want what we deserve. So that's why we're here. That's what we're doing, and that's the message that we're sending.
We are Tuesday. We are Tuesday.
We are here to let BlackRock, one of the major investors in Warrior Met Coal, to let BlackRock know how Warrior Met Coal is treating their coal miners and how they're conducting business down in Alabama. Like I said, we're very upset. I think enough is enough. And we want to let them know what they're investing in and how their people are conducting business.
Thanks to the Real News Network for that clip from Mike Wright, a striking Alabama coal miner at Warrior Met who traveled to Manhattan to protest in front of BlackRock's offices. BlackRock is the world's largest hedge fund and Warrior Met's largest shareholder. And today we are talking about the five-month strike by Alabama coal miners with Kim Kelly, a labor columnist at Teen Vogue and freelance contributor whose work has appeared in many publications, including The Washington Post and The Nation. Kim, let's talk about media coverage. On July 16th, so that's been about a little more than two weeks, Media Matters came out and said this strike has not had one mention from CNN or MSNBC. Do you know if that's still the case?
Oh, yeah, and Fox News either, who you would think would theoretically be all over this kind of story. There's been a lot of local coverage, and like some local affiliates have been out, And I know for a fact that ABC News is working on a piece that should be out pretty soon, but it's really been an uphill battle to get kind of, I mean, for lack of a better term, the mainstream media to pay attention to this strike. I'm an independent journalist. I've been on it for a long time. Other independent journalists and smaller progressive outlets have been covering it more. And there has been more of an uptick in interest I've seen, especially since, you know, the BlackRock action in New York, I think, is very clever tactically to sort of bring the fight to the media's doorstep and be like, look, if y'all aren't going to come down to Alabama, we'll come up to Manhattan, you know, as long as you come pay attention. But it is the strangest thing. You think it would be front page news, especially given all the vehicular assaults on the people on the picket lines.
Tell us more about those vehicular assaults.
Yeah, for sure. We're up to, and this is just documented that I've heard about, and, you know, these are out on rural roads where there's not a cell phone service. A lot can happen on a dark country road, but I know for a fact that at least 5 instances of company-affiliated, whether it's a boss or a scab, someone who works with the company, company-affiliated trucks and cars driving directly into the picket line and hitting people. Several strikers have been sent to the hospital. One striker was hit, and then a couple weeks later, his wife, who was out in the picket line supporting them, Amy, she was hit, and they're all still feeling those after effects. The local police have done nothing. The company has issued, you know, wishy-washy PR babble about how they don't condone violence, but it keeps happening. And this is something that is a big deal. I mean, it's as if they're trying to get away with murder at this point, and it should be a huge national story.
Have you been able to talk to anyone from Warrior Met or BlackRock?
Nah. I mean, I did get comment from their PR representative for a story on Elle that's coming out this week. That took pulling some teeth. But they're not very chatty. You know, they're not really that interested in addressing this strike. I think they're hoping that it'll go away. But that's certainly not going to be the case.
Again, Kim, I mean, as you say, some of these workers are preparing for Christmas. So they're in this for the long haul.
Yeah, coal miners don't back down. You know, the MWA has a very long history in Alabama, stretching back to 1890. You know, coal miners, just as people who have to deal with this profession, like, they're very tough and strong and stubborn, and they're used to having to fight for what they deserve and what they need. I mean, this is the biggest coal miner strike, and I think perhaps the biggest labor action in Alabama in the past 40 years. But, you know, 40 years ago, there was another strike, and some people's fathers and grandfathers and, you know, family members remember that. There's such a deep institutional and generational memory of struggle in these folks' bones. And, you know, the fact that it's stretched on for so long, I think it's just a testament to how stubborn these guys are and how unwilling they are to give up. So if you've invested this long into this fight, you're not going to turn around and, you know, tuck your tail between your legs and go home 5 months into a strike. You're going to ride it out. And they've made it very clear that they're going to be there one day longer, one day stronger. And, you know, they're not going to give up. You know, they can't.
Well, Kim, thanks so much for your reporting, and thank you for joining us. We'd love to have you back.
Yeah, thank you so much for shining light on this struggle. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. That is Kim Kelly, a labor columnist at Teen Vogue and a freelance contributor whose work has appeared in many publications, including The Washington Post. Kim is working on a book, Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. It'll be out next April. On today's Your Call, we're starting a regular series on worker uprisings across the country. And now we are going to talk about Frito-Lay workers in Topeka, Kansas. On July 5th, hundreds of workers at the Frito-Lay manufacturing and distribution plant went on strike over poor working conditions and what workers call suicide shifts. Workers say that they're forced to put in 84-hour weeks. Many said they work 12-hour shifts with as little as 8 hours in between. The strike lasted 19 days until July 24th, when more than 600 Frito-Lay workers signed a union contract that raises wages and guarantees at least one day off a week. That is one day off a week. The New York Times reports that one warehouse worker who's been at the plant for about 2 decades said there was more disappointment than happiness with the contract. The man who wanted anonymity, fearful of retaliation, said many workers who crossed the picket line or voted to approve the contract did so out of need. He said a lot of people had to vote yes because they were running out of money and did not have insurance. Frito-Lay, the maker of Doritos, Lay's, Tostitos, and Cheetos, is owned by Pepsi. Frito-Lay brought in $4.5 billion in the second quarter, accounting for 23% of PepsiCo's revenue, according to the Washington Post. Ramon LaGuardia, CEO and chair of PepsiCo, made $21 million in 2020, according to the AFL-CIO. The company's CEO pay is 462 times its median employee's pay. Joining us to give you an update are two guests. Max Alvarez is a writer and editor in Baltimore. He's editor-in-chief at The Real News Network and host of the Working People podcast. Hi, Max. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. Samuel Huntsman has worked at the Frito-Lay plant in Topeka for almost 4 years, and he helped organize the worker strike. Hi, Sam. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, great to have you, Sam. First off, can you just tell us what your experience has been like working at this plant in Topeka? I mean, it's shocking to read some of the workers just talking about what they deal with, back-to-back 12-hour shifts with only an 8-hour break. Can you just tell us more about this?
When you first start, you're in the warehouse, either loading the trailers or GES, picking bags and putting them in a box, kind of like Amazon. And when I was there, you know, you get forced to work 12 sometimes. It's off and on. It really wasn't that bad. You have to hit your score. That's the hardest part. But then when I left that department and went to the warehouse last year during COVID hit, it was a mess. The people who left, they got forced 12, 7 days a week. And then the suicides where you have to stay over your 8-hour shift 4 more hours, then you go home and sleep. Some people only get like 5-6 hours of sleep because they live 30 minutes out of town. So then they got to come back at, I work third shift. So you got to come back at 7 p.m. and then work until 7 a.m. So it's really hard on your body and hard on your family. If you have kids like me, you know, you don't have time to see them. Just get up, get ready for work and leave.
Sam, when you interviewed for the job, did this come up in just discussions about your work schedule?
No, not really. They just said in the beginning, yeah, there's going to be lots of overtime sometimes or whenever it's busy. And so we're like, okay, we'll see how it goes. And then it wasn't too bad. But then when you go into the warehouse, like the forklift drivers and the people who load the trailers, they get forced a lot because they can't keep no one because everyone quits or gets fired because the forklift drivers, they have to hit score two of how many pallets they move a minute. So a lot of people just say, I'm not doing this, so they quit. So they got to force everyone to work 12 to get everything shipped out.
Have many workers, before the strike happened, did workers talk to executives saying it's humanly impossible to work this many hours, we need breaks? And if so, what was the response?
Yeah, I was even one of them. Our union leader, Brent Hall, he posted a picture to us, like in our group chat, and about the corporate's phone number and their email. So he told us all to email and call him about the working conditions and treatment. And then I got like an automated response email saying that they'll have someone look into it. And then a couple days later, I went to the human resources at the Topeka plant, had a meeting with me, and listened to my concerns, but nothing was really done about it, about like hiring more people or putting bids up in more departments where like you have to bid on jobs and whoever has the highest seniority gets the job.
Vice News spoke to Mark McCarter, a 59-year-old union steward at Frito-Lay, who's worked at the Topeka facility for 37 years since he was just 19. And he said, after 37 years, I still get forced to work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. I can tell you that many people have had heart attacks in the heat at Frito-Lay since I've been here. One guy died a few years ago, and the company had people pick him up, move him over to the side, and put another person in his spot without shutting the business down for 2 seconds. It seems like I go to one funeral a year for someone who's had a heart attack at work or someone who went home to their barn and shot themselves in the head or hung themselves. Sam, this is just shocking to read.
Yeah, it is.
Can you just tell us more about this?
I think the person who died in the kitchen, it was way before I worked there. Well, from what I hear, in this couple years ago, like 10 years ago. But I know there's, when I was there, not in my department, but someone died of a heart attack in the warehouse side, and they helped him, but they the ambulance people, they couldn't get to him on time. What I've heard, like, needs to be more management helping, you know, the first responders in to find the person that's hurt.
Max, what can you tell us about this?
I mean, it's as shocking and horrifying as it sounds. And I think that, you know, perhaps what is even more shocking and more horrifying is that this is happening in workplaces all over the country. This has been the kind of general trend in the U.S. kind of labor force for a number of decades, right? I mean, over the past, you know, 40 years or so, since basically the 1970s, what we have seen is that workers, by and large, are working more hours. We are more productive. We are producing more profits. And yet, real wages have been slow to grow. The minimum wage has, I think, now been, we have not raised the federal minimum wage for the longest period in U.S. history. All the while, the cost of living is going up. Right now, we're experiencing the squeeze of inflation. So working people are, you know, working more and actually able to afford even less. This is kind of the general squeeze that has been put on working people in so many industries across the board, where you know, folks like Sam are being kind of worked to the bone and able to kind of do less and less with it. And all the while, you are losing your more ability to see your family, to see your friends, to take time off, to go on vacation, to basically live your life. And I think that one of the things that's been really striking to me on my show, Working People, and in the coverage that we've been doing at the Real News Network, talking to workers in different industries around the country, is that so many folks are kind of saying the same things, right? You know, what workers in Topeka, Kansas, and it's important to note that Frito-Lay workers around the country were saying, like, hey, we're experiencing this too. So it's definitely a generalized trend that workers at Frito-Lay are experiencing, while, as you mentioned, Frito-Lay and its parent company, PepsiCo, are raking in massive profits. Folks are being worked to the bone, just like Amazon workers in Bessemer were describing when they were doing their union drive. They said, we're treated like robots. We're worked to the bone and we have nothing left to give. And that's why you have such high turnover at Amazon. You just had the brilliant Kim Kelly, who's done a number of reports on the UMWA miner strike in Alabama for us here at The Real News. workers there are saying the same thing. They're saying we were basically absentee parents because we're underground most of the time. The mine is more productive. We've turned a profit for this company. And yet, Warrior Met Coal is refusing to even like see us as human beings who deserve the right to have time off and to be able to live the life that we want with the money that we get from our paychecks. Teachers are working more hours, especially during the pandemic, with prep and all the additional labor that goes into kind of preparing for virtual learning. Gig workers around the country have seen these black boxed algorithms change without any real democratic say over what that those algorithms do. So workers around the board, whether they're driving for Uber, Lyft, or delivering for Shipt and other services like that, they're seeing decreases in the amount of money they're pulling in. And so thus they're working more hours just to make the same amount, if not less. I mean, this is happening all over the place. And I think that workers are starting to say like, hey, this is not okay. We're getting a really raw deal here. There's more to life than this. And we're fed up with it. And yet the you know, bosses are, they can't help themselves. They just want to squeeze people more and more because fundamentally they do not see us as human beings. They see us as pieces of machinery that can generate profit for them. They don't care about all the family dinners and birthdays we're missing. They really don't.
Sam, can you talk more about what Max just said here, just in terms of, you know, the way that you and your coworkers are treated, and what got you to get up and organize this strike?
I could compare to what he said, for Frito-Lay, it seems like they care more about their machines than they do their workers operating the machines. Like if something a machine breaks, they try to blame it on you because you cost them lots of money and downtime. So they try to put the blame on whoever was using that machine. And that's kind of what we pushed us to the limit of striking. We just had enough because it's that's what happens inside Frito-Lay, is constant revenge coming after the workers for doing something minor wrong, or if something breaks, that's not our fault. They just want someone to blame.
Sam, what can you tell us about what happened during the strike and why you all decided to sign this new contract that raises wages, according to the company, 4%, if you can give us more information about that, and then guarantees one day off a week? I had to read this sentence 3 times. You're guaranteed only one day off a week?
Yeah, and it's only, or it was in the last proposal, the one day a week, but it wasn't guaranteed. It wasn't written in the contract. It was just like, take the company's word for it. So we're like, no. So that was another reason why we striked, and that's all we got on the strike, is it's in the contract now, one day guaranteed off, but it's still kind of a punishment because they put in there, if you take a vacation day or call in sick or call in for any reason, that takes away your guaranteed day off, because they call that your day off. So then they can force you to work your weekend, your guaranteed one day off, and your other weekend. So still kind of, they're still punishing us for not working.
Max, you spoke with Sherry Renfro, who's a union member who's been working with Frito-Lay for 10 years, who said that she was disappointed that the majority accepted this offer. She said, we had the power to make real change, and enough of us lost faith in the process. I mean, for so many workers, it's hard to go on strike because they have families to feed.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, like, you know, it's important for all of us, you know, who support workers and who are doing the work in media to lift up workers' struggles, you know, understand, right, the kind of human stakes, not only of what working people go through on a day-to-day basis, but also, yeah, like what the real messy reality of organizing and going on strike is. It is a very big deal to go on strike, especially when, you know, you have been beaten down so relentlessly by a company like Frito-Lay for so long, right? Frito-Lay is constantly reminding its workers that they are expendable, that their lives and bodies and families don't matter. And if you work under those conditions for long enough, like, you start to believe it. Like, I remember this time 10 years ago, I was working as a temp in, you know, these warehouses in Southern California, and we would be working like 12-hour days. And at the end of each day, the managers would line us up on the cold concrete floor and walk down the line and point to the temps that they wanted to come back the next day. And every single day, no matter how long you'd worked there, no matter how much you had proven yourself to be a good worker, you face that indignity of them really kind of making a demonstration of how expendable you were and how much your life and your livelihood depended on being in the boss's good graces, right? If you, that's a form of psychological warfare that working people around this country endure in so many big and small ways every day. Sherry Renfro, who you mentioned, had a really, I think, poignant detail in our conversation on my podcast, Working People, that really stuck with me, because she said, you know, when I got hired, and when new folks get hired at Frito-Lay now, when they're kind of walking new hirees through the plant and kind of telling them how things work, one of the things they'll do is they'll point to the break room, and they'll say, they call it a visitation room, and they say, oh, your family can come and visit you on your breaks. And Sherry said, you know, that sounded nice at the beginning, but then I stopped and thought, where have I heard that term before? And it's what you hear, a visitation room is what they have in prisons, right? It's like, it should not be a selling point that the one time that you may get to see your kids while they're awake is when they come to your work and you see them for like 15 minutes on your break. But when you leave for work in the morning and when you come back home at night, they're asleep, right? That should not be a selling point. But again, this is a constant form of psychological warfare. And you add on to that the destruction of the organized labor movement over the past half century. We have a long way to go, but I think, you know, it is really inspiring and hopeful that more and more workers, especially after the COVID-19 pandemic, are refusing to accept that we are worth that little. And we are saying we deserve more, and more people are standing up, like Sam, like his coworkers, and we should all be supporting that.
Max Alvarez is a writer and editor based in Baltimore. He's editor-in-chief at The Real News Network and host of the Working People podcast. Sam Huntsman has worked at the Frito-Lay plant in Topeka for almost 4 years and helped organize the Frito-Lay worker strike. Max and Sam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. And before we get to our next segment, we just wanted to play a clip from More Perfect Union. And this clip is about Brandon Ingram, who worked at Frito-Lay and received a number of worker certificates. On October 2nd, 2016, he was electrocuted at work. And here he is explaining what happened.
Was using a dock door. You press the button and it automatically does what it's supposed to do. I got electrocuted. I was taken to the ER, but the emergency room they took me to was 45 minutes away. We passed four hospitals on the way to the hospital they wanted to take me to. And the reason it is because they sign a contract with a certain hospital and a certain network.
From the very next day after the accident, my husband was never the same. He was working really hard to even just get up on to the side of the bed. Usually he's like hops out of bed and he hurries up, puts his clothes on, and he shoves food down his throat and he's out the door. You know, in 30 minutes, he was used to it. He was trained to do that in the service.
When I say I was healthy as an ox, I was healthy as an ox.
We just didn't have any answers. They said he should have been fine, but he wasn't.
I didn't get any time off after the incident. I was... I had to call off the next day as a sick day. I told you I was in pain. I told you it hurts when I walk. And it was like, okay, you know, are you going to be here tomorrow? I was a site lead and I know what that entails. You're a leadership of the whole warehouse, so if you have to fill in, you have to fill in. I asked for some type of relief, period, because I was still obligated to work, like picking cases and unloading trucks or rotating product on a forklift. I asked for a chair that I could probably sit in that would make me more comfortable while I'm doing my office work. They denied it. You're either 100% or you can't work. It just felt like they was just trying to push me out. Eventually, I got an MRI by my primary doctor, and he showed that I had two herniated discs in my back. And he was like, you shouldn't be doing anything. They could only fix it with surgery.
And my husband still had to work this whole entire time.
Thanks to More Perfect Union for that clip, Brandon Ingram talking about being electrocuted at work, and his wife, Melissa, talking about what his family and her family have endured. And you can find the entire clip at yourcallradio.org. Again, Frito-Lay workers signed a new contract that raises wages and guarantees at least one day off every week. We have a statement from Frito-Lay on our website. They say, today we're proud to employ more than 66,000 people and are committed to providing a safe and fair workplace for everyone. Coming up after a quick break, we will continue talking about worker uprisings across the country. We're going to focus on garment workers in Los Angeles who are still fighting for a minimum wage. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to get an update on California's SB62, known as the Garment Worker Protection Act. We have covered this issue many, many times on the show. Garment workers in Los Angeles are still fighting for a minimum wage. They are currently paid per piece and make as little as $150 a week. Daisy Gonzalez is organizing director with the Garment Worker Center in Los Angeles. Hi, Daisy. Thank you for joining us again.
Hi. Thank you for having us.
So last time we spoke, the bill did not pass, but it is back. SB62, sponsored by California State Senator Maria Elena Durazo. It recently passed through the state's Assembly Judiciary Committee by a vote of 8-3. Can you give us an update on where the bill is now?
Sure. So the bill right now is in the Assembly Appropriations Committee. As soon as legislators are back in session on August 14th, I believe, you know, we'll be getting a date for the next vote in that committee. The following step would be that the full assembly of the state would vote on SB 62. And the last step would be to get Governor Newsom's signature on the bill.
Can you remind us why this didn't pass last time around?
Sure. Last year, because of the pandemic, the legislative calendar was actually shortened. And, you know, due to the pandemic, there were some, you know, starts and stops. So, you know, towards the end of session, there were many bills that had to still be voted on. Our bill was just not called up for a vote, along with many others. And unfortunately, it died in the on the assembly floor.
You all have been holding a number of actions over the past couple of weeks. What are you hearing from politicians in Sacramento this time around?
Yeah, we have been organizing lots of actions and mobilizing as much as we can and as safely as we can. And just last week, we were in front of the Ronald Reagan State Building, where, you know, the president of the assembly, the, you know, Senate pro tem and the governor all have offices. So we held an action with close to 100 garment workers. We had support from our, you know, principal co-author, Marielena Durazo. We also had Ron Herrera, the president of the LA County Labor Federation. And so, you know, we're getting lots of support. We, you know, have gotten through the entire Senate. We have a number of co-authors that have also signed up for the bill. So, yeah, we're optimistic.
No, when we've had you on in the past, Daisy, we talked about the fact that garment workers in Los Angeles are making as little as $2.68 an hour. They are paid per piece. Can you remind us, how is this legal?
That is correct. So garment workers can, you know, legally be paid per piece, but they should be guaranteed a minimum wage. The problem is that, you know, wage theft is just so ingrained in this industry that workers are only paid a piece rate. And those piece rates can, you know, vary from 2 cents to 10 or 15 cents. You know, we hear from workers that often, you know, halfway through the production of a specific garment, you know, employers will change the piece rate. They'll lower it in order to, you know, meet whatever profit margins they're trying to meet. And so, you know, that's why it's so important for our bill to not only eliminate the piece rate, but also include brand accountability, right? We've seen in countless studies, we've heard directly from employers that, you know, wage theft is really coming from the top of the supply chain. You know, brands are not, they're not paying enough for orders. And that results in employers at, you know, the factory level, not being able to even meet minimum wage requirements for their employers, for their employees.
Can you name some of these brands? Last time we spoke, Ross is one of the well-known brands where clothing is made in these factories.
Yeah, you know, our top five violators are, and this is something that you can check out in the industry report that we released in December of last year. But the top five brands that we see being produced include Fashion Nova, Forever 21, Windsor, Urban Outfitters, and Ross.
And you can find links to these brands and learn more about it at yourcallradio.org. At that protest, Maria Morales, a garment worker, said, "I'm a garment worker for 20 years. I'm a trimmer. I can't believe the exploitation continues. In these years, I have only seen the piece rate up by 4 cents. A lot of these workers are immigrant women. Can you tell us, Daisy, we had you on many times during the pandemic, and these women and men still went to work. They had no choice. A lot of people got sick from COVID, and sadly, people died. Can you just talk about, you know, what a typical week is like for these workers? How difficult is this work, given that they're making about $150 a week?
Yeah, a typical day for a garment worker is a 12-hour workday. Most workers start work at 7 a.m. They leave the factory at about 6 p.m. or 7 p.m. They also work Saturdays. It tends to be a half day on Saturday. If, you know, there's a lot of work, employers expect workers to come in even on Sundays. So it could be a seven day work week for garment workers. And, you know, these are 100% sweatshops. They are, you know, factories that often are, you know, windowless. They, you know, are, you know, crammed with machines. There's no availability in so many factories for social distancing. They're often, you know, rat and roach infested. And, you know, during the pandemic, workers continued to make not only clothing, but also PPE, right? They were sewing face masks. They were, you know, sewing and trimming hospital robes. And, you know, employers were not mandating or even providing face masks for their employees. You know, again, sweatshop environments, meaning that the bathrooms are also, you know, we hear from workers, just filthy. They don't provide hand soap, right? So to this day, you know, workers are still in factories that just don't have, you know, any of the basic necessities to prevent outbreaks from occurring in the workplace.
And again, we're talking about factories in Los Angeles. women making clothing for million-dollar, billion-dollar brands like Forever 21. Daisy, given that this is happening right now in the California Senate, what can citizens do about this if they want to get involved?
Yeah, right now, I think it's really important to reach out to your assembly member and let them know that you are in support of this bill. You know, we really do need to protect all workers. And I just think it's really important to note, right, that these are workers that helped us get through the pandemic, right? And we need our assembly members to hear that. We need Governor Newsom to hear that and to ensure that, you know, when we talk about, you know, workplace protections, when we talk about, you know, support for our immigrant community, for women of color, this includes garment workers as well. And we want to make sure that, you know, this bill is approved this year.
In our last minute, are you expecting a fight with the California Chamber of Commerce?
You know, the chamber is the group that is opposing this this legislation, and we've actually secured over 150 businesses to sign on as endorsers of the bill. This includes businesses that produce here in California and others who are interested in producing here in California and haven't because of the widespread sweatshop culture that exists, right? So they're, you know, supportive of this bill, hoping that you know, that the manufacturing, the apparel manufacturing environment here in California will change, and you know, they're looking forward to bringing business here. And you know, what we're seeing is that, you know, the chamber is, you know, speaking for business, but they don't have, you know, businesses that are really coming to the forefront. So, you know, I think this bill, you know, really speaks for how beneficial it will be, not just for workers, but also for a more sustainable and ethical fashion environment.
Daisy Gonzalez is organizing director with the Garment Worker Center in Los Angeles. They have been holding rallies to get support for California Senate Bill 62, known as the Garment Worker Protection Act. It would guarantee garment workers a minimum wage. They are currently paid per piece and earn as little as $150 a week, making clothing for top brands like H&M and Forever 21. Daisy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And you can find more information about this and the other worker actions we talked about today at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Joanne Marr for engineering our show. You can listen to past shows, sign up for our podcast, and share today's show with friends at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.